Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a CDC conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. CDC, as in the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Back in 1947, the United States was waging war, not against the Nazis, but against a small little insect, the mosquito. The mosquitoes were spreading deadly malaria. And the Communicable Disease Center was established and armed with $10 million and 400 employees, as well as trucks, sprayers, and shovels to clear out mosquito-infected swamps. Through the years, the CDC became experts in epidemiology and public health. Think tuberculosis, smallpox, rubella. You may not hear so much about these diseases because prevention efforts have been successful. In 1972, the CDC established a gonorrhea control program. My listeners know that I'm very jealous of sexually infected diseases. They get all the prevention and treatment efforts that's lacking in substance use. The CDC is famous or infamous for the COVID efforts, another infection that I covet in terms of prevention and financial backing. CDC has several different units working on different diseases and injury prevention, even one dedicated to cannabis. To learn more about the CDC's Cannabis Strategy Unit, I reached out to Dr. Doug Raylor. Dr. Doug Raylor serves as health scientist for the Cannabis Strategy Unit in the Division of Overdose Prevention at CDC's National Center for Injury Prevention and Control. His work has focused on CDC's Cannabis Strategic Plan, cannabis research, and prevention of drug-related overdoses. Dr. Raylor earned his PhD and MPH in health behavior and health education. He has published extensively on cannabis, drug overdoses, traffic safety, youth violence, and child injury prevention in various prestigious journals. To learn more about Dr. Douglas Raylor, check out the High Truths show notes. Dr. Douglas Raylor, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
I am very excited to have you here. CDC Cannabis Unit, like, wow. I don't think people even know that there is such a thing. And from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, the top of the top in the world in terms of public health. So my question to you, was this always your goal to reach for the stars? And how did your path, your personal journey get you to be part of the CDC?
Yeah, it was not my goal. I didn't even know about public health when I first, when I was doing my schooling. I first got involved in injury prevention in general. So I started out working on my master's in public health at the University of Michigan, and I was involved in learning about road safety. And, I learned that motor vehicle crashes are preventable. All of them are preventable in some way, in some capacity. And I went to the CDC between my master or for one summer during my MPH program. And I was housed in the Division of Unintentional Injury Prevention. The Division of Unintentional Injury Prevention at the time, they're involved in motor vehicle crashes, falls, burns, just any sort of injury that is not intentional. That's the Division of Violence Prevention, is the intentional piece. I went back and then I was there for 2 years working on global road safety work. And then I went back to school to get my PhD. And that was more in terms of youth violence prevention. And through networking and continuing to be more involved in injury prevention, I wound up back at CDC working on the non-fatal overdose surveillance team. And this was my first sort of foray into substance use and drug prevention. And at the time, so this was probably 4 years ago, the CDC was getting quite a bit of funding from the government to when they were first starting to combat the opioid epidemic. So there was quite a bit of restructuring in our division, the Division of Unintentional Injury Prevention, because in DUIP, most of our funding at the time was to combat the opioid epidemic. And we learned that, there wasn't any place at CDC that was specifically focusing on drug prevention. So DUIP became the Division of Overdose Prevention. And in time, we realized that there wasn't any, we started looking at other drugs. It wasn't just opioids. We were starting to look at stimulants and heroin and starting to look at cannabis. And we saw that there wasn't any singular place at CDC that was coordinating the cannabis work for the whole agency. There was a little bit of cannabis work going on in the Office of Smoking and Health. There was some cannabis work going on in labs, maternal child health. They had some, but there just was, but it was sort of an ad hoc system, if you will. So the Division of Overdose Prevention realized that let's stand up a cannabis strategy unit. And that's sort of, I raised my hand and I was able to get the position, and I've been involved for the past 4 or 5 years in the cannabis strategy unit, helping to set the strategic plan for CDC, and really capitalizing on what CDC is good at. You know, we're good at providing technical assistance. We're good at surveillance. That's really the bread and butter of CDC. So we haven't been around long, but I feel like we've done a pretty good job laying the bones for the cannabis strategy unit. And now we're starting to coordinate with other agencies across the federal government. We still have a long ways to go, but we now have a good history of doing solid work, and I'm excited for what these next 5 years will bring.
That's awesome. So the unit's been around since what year?
2020. We got off the ground just before COVID.
Oh, wow. That's great. So, okay. So this is not a CDC cannabis unit, CDC strategy cannabis unit. That's interesting why the name, like tobacco doesn't have the word strategy. The CDC tobacco unit doesn't have it. Is there a reason behind the name?
Yeah, I think if I had to guess, it was because we didn't really know where we were going to go with in the cannabis space when we first started. And we are not, we're in the cannabis strategy unit, we don't do all the work for the agency. We help lead the strategic direction for the agency. So, there's still a bunch of cannabis work that goes on across the agency. We're just helping to ensure that it's a consistent message. We're helping to, we don't just do research or surveillance. We also do strategic planning for the agency and with other agencies.
You know what I'm realizing when you're saying that it came about in 2020, that was after E-Valley, right? When the CDC really went into gear with their central command center and going after E-Valley very successfully, by the way. I was so proud of the CDC's work on that. And E-Valley, for our listeners, as a reminder, was the vaping disease associated with cannabis. And I'm wondering if that sparked a thing like, hey, we should be looking at this more closely.
Yeah, and I'm embarrassed I didn't mention that. And as you said, the E-Valley epidemic, it was how the response was housed in our division, and based off of the, as you said, the strong work that came out from that response, It also gave us confidence that the cannabis strategy unit should or does belong in the Division of Overdose Prevention, because, you know, we had developed expertise in that space.
Yeah, I remember watching that and I was really amazed. I mean, there was the unit, we got reports every day, there was a number of cases tracking it. And it was a complicated surveillance because it was the CDC that I think did human testing, but the FDA did the testing on the vape products themselves. And then that information came together. And then the messaging, and I was involved in editing some of the messaging for CDC as far as safety, like, you know, don't use, or if you're going to use, then don't, you know, get adulterate, you know, the vape products. And I thought that was really well, and it was successful because, you know, you got the numbers down, people stopped dying in the numbers, in the great numbers. There were 68 deaths, I think, 2000 hospitalizations. And I think it was kind of like a dress rehearsal for COVID.
Yeah. But I'm also, I don't think that, I think it's important for us not to forget about Udalee too, because I think that it's highly likely that we're going to have something similar in the future in terms of these products that are tainted, and I think there's an opportunity for things to get out of hand in terms of product getting released into the market that is not pure, is not tested, because it's the same, it could, potential for same mechanism,
yeah,
of harm.
You're right, and the cases hasn't gone away, but it hasn't. It's not at an epidemic level. I think about 6 months ago, one of my colleagues took care of a young person who probably had EVALI. I think the medical team kind of forgot about that diagnosis, but when I heard about, you know, a 20-year-old, you know, on ECMO with a heart ejection fracture of 14%, it's like that's what he had, and he recovered, but you know, it's a long journey. But so I'm sure those cases exist. So tell us what is the strategic plan? What does the unit do?
Sure. We are a little bit more background. We haven't been around very long. We have a very small team. When we're up at full capacity, it's me and one other colleague who are working on this full time. We have a couple fellows that are part of the team, and we don't have a budget. So all of our funding comes from discretionary funds from the Injury Center. I think like I said, the main things that we focus on is epidemiology and surveillance. Evaluation of trying to learn more about what are the effects of policy. We get a lot of requests for technical assistance from states in terms of you know, they may have just passed a law and, you know, they need cannabis 101 training. We do a lot of work in responding or reviewing. Reviewing legislation that might go to the House or Senate floor to make sure that what's being proposed in these bills, and when it mentioned CDC, is that work that we can actually do? Is that work that we can support? We have about five or six pillars that make up our strategic plan. So if you want, I can go through those really quickly.
Sure.
The first one is advancing research. So when advancing research. What I mean here is we work with connecting federal partners with academic partners on our research priorities, needs, and opportunities. We are trying to learn more about the health effects of cannabis use, specifically for how cannabis policies affect medical use of cannabis and opioid prescribing. We're trying to, these are just examples of some of the work that we're doing in the advancing research space. We're trying to understand how expecting mothers use cannabis, and there's still a bunch that we don't know in terms of cannabis use during pregnancy. How does it affect the unborn baby? So that's just one example of the advancing research pillar. The next one, which I think is our strongest pillar, is monitoring trends. So we're monitoring exposure to cannabis and its associated health effects. We have been working with the National Center for Health Statistics on cognitive testing of cannabis questions. So that means, are the questions that we're asking, are we actually getting the data back that we need? Are people understanding the questions in a way that they're intended? So we have a big project. We've recently tested about 17 different questions. We're now doing the second round of cognitive testing, and I think the hope is that these cognitively tested questions will be pushed out to some of our population level surveys.
Can you explain what that means? Does that mean like, is it kind of like a dementia test or like altered mental status test, or what is?
Yeah. So for example, we'll have a prompt that, for the following questions, when we talk about cannabis, we're talking about THC products, and we're not including, please don't include CBD products. So like, that's it. Let's pretend that that's the prompt. So we'll do focus groups and or individual interviews with potential respondents, saying like, how do you interpret this prompt? Do you understand all the words that are in this prompt? When you see the word cannabis, what are you thinking of? So it's really like in-depth interviewing with potential survey respondents to really make sure they understand, what the prompt might say, in order for us to get
a survey that makes sense.
And the way that we interpret the question is the same way that they're interpreting the question.
It's fascinating. I recently had a podcast with educators on drug driving for teens, high school students. And it was interesting that teens did not know that cannabis means marijuana.
Yeah. I mean, that's just an example of, this is so, the cannabis space is so complicated, and it's changing every day. And, just basic understandings of the word cannabis or the word marijuana, like we still have a long way to go in terms of even addressing that. I mean, in the cannabis strategy unit, we are constantly kept on our toes. And really basic understanding of cannabis use, we don't have a good grasp of it, because we've recently learned that folks who use cannabis, they don't necessarily even know what sort of product that they're using. They don't know what it's composed of. Is it THC? Is it CBD? Is it a hybrid of the two? So we're challenged when we're trying to figure out more about cannabis use, when many cannabis users don't actually know what they're using.
That's so true. And I see that in the emergency room. The other day, I had a guy who came in with like a panic attack and anxiety. And he said, I went to a concert yesterday and I just took a hit off a stranger's blunt. And I asked him, do you want me to test and see what comes up? And there was no THC in it. It was just amphetamines. It was strange. But you're right. People don't intentionally, and they think that it's natural. I had a pregnant lady the other day who's like, well, it's just a plant, why should I, I use it for my morning sickness. She openly admitted, using marijuana while pregnant. And she's probably didn't have, the perfect cognition to begin with. And that just, the marijuana just made it worse. So what are you learning, since we were talking about the words cannabis or marijuana? I know the cannabis industry wants the public not to use the word marijuana, and have a whole campaign of words. But I use both cannabis and marijuana because the medical literature does both. And I think like we figured out, teens don't even know what cannabis is. So what, for your unit, you called the cannabis unit, but do you freely use the word marijuana, or
We have to. I mean, because if we're trying to connect with the population, you have to use the words that are being used in the population. We tend to use cannabis as sort of the umbrella term, and we use marijuana when we're referring to high THC products. What we'll often do is we'll refer, like in when we write up papers and whatnot, we'll call it cannabis, but at the beginning we'll do in parentheses also referred to as marijuana, or we'll talk about how for marijuana we really mean more like the mind altering product. But yeah, we tend to use both. If you go to our website, we mainly use, I think we would just transitioned over to cannabis, but you'll find both on there. But in our population level surveys, in our prompts, we'll definitely include both of them and try to be very specific about what we want the respondents to think about when we say cannabis or when we use marijuana.
That's great. And then CDC and all the units at CDC are very much data-driven and epidemiologic-driven. What are the sources of data that you're currently using or following, or are you making your own, as you were mentioned, by these survey questions that you're testing?
Yes. So there are a couple different surveys that we're using. I think mainly the CDC surveys. And these are the surveys that we have access to. So there's the behavioral risk factor surveillance survey, or surveillance system, BRFSS. So this is a survey that goes out to folks that are 18 or older across the United States. There's one or two questions that are on there about cannabis or marijuana use. They call it marijuana. And then the Division of Overdose Prevention, we fund a marijuana optional module. So we just revised this module. And the way that BRFSS works is states can opt to take on this module. So they have to pay a little bit more money in order to use this module. But it's a cognitively tested module. And we just revised it so that we're now asking, what are all the different forms or the different routes of administration or the different modes of use that they've used in the past 30 days? Previously, it asked just what is the most common mode of use. Now we're asking, like, what are all the different modes of use? So again, when I talk about
that's so important because it makes a difference. Are you vaping? Are you smoking? Are you dabbing? Are you waxing? Or
very basic research questions that we don't know the answers to. And the great thing about BRFSS is it includes a whole host of different health topics. So we're able to see those who are frequent users and those who are vaping. You know, what are the other health concerns that they have? What are the other health behaviors that they have? And we're able to start to try to find some linkages between them. So BRFSS is a really great source that we use. We also use syndromic surveillance. So syndromic surveillance, when we talk about it, it's when folks report to the emergency department, we're able to capture why their chief complaint. So what does the patient say is the main reason why they're there? And we are able to link that with discharge data and billing data. So this is real-time data, and we're able to understand, what are the rates of folks that are reporting to the emergency department for cannabis-involved reasons. And we're able to look at that across the United States. So that's a really great surveillance source that we're using, and we've been able to publish quite a bit.
Doug, I have a great idea for you.
Yes.
Seeing that you're getting this data from the emergency departments, as an emergency physician, I know that we do a terrible job in encoding the information that you need to make these conclusions. So I'm kind of proposing that you write an article either for the you could think about whether you want it in the Journal of the Annals of Emergency Medicine, or in one of our, like we call it, the throwaway magazine that most people actually read, and put a call out. Like I wrote one of these articles already for locally for the San Diego Medical Society, but just a plea to include not just cannabis, but any drug in the diagnosis, because I know that that data goes to you and you're making important decisions based on that and you're not getting that data. So perhaps we can, you know, put a call out to the emergency medicine community, especially since you're getting their data and you're making conclusions on that, because there is no coding for cannabis hyperemesis syndrome or cannabis-induced psychosis. So you'll just get vomiting and you'll never know the true number of cannabis hyperemesis syndrome patients that we're seeing.
Yeah, and actually one of the six pillars of the Cannabis Strategy Unit is to support health systems and healthcare providers. And to be honest, like this is a space where we need to do more work. So I think that's a fantastic idea, and something that we should most certainly explore.
Yeah, and then the other one, if you're looking for health systems, I'd work with Epic as far as like, you know, have your ideal module. Like I have at triage, they're always asking, do you smoke, drink, or use drugs? No. But people don't think about marijuana. So, and there's always, now there's a vaping question because, you know, somebody, you know, was able to put that in. But if you had like a couple extra questions or saw what Epic usually does and work with them, you could add to their screening and then you can get, you know, better data that way. Because right now there's no marijuana questions. There's, you know, tobacco and alcohol and sometimes vaping.
Yeah. Well, let's talk.
Yeah. That was very cool. So that gets me to my next question that I was going is, what data is missing, or do you even know what data is missing?
What data is missing?
A lot. Great.
So I think, as I was alluding to earlier, some of the most important surveillance data points are often the most difficult to capture. You know, what are people using? How are they using it? How much are they using it? There are some great efforts to work to revise some surveys and to revise questions. Some of the work that David Hammond's doing up in Canada is a really great example of this. They're showing pictures of products to try to get a better understanding of increased accuracy of reporting in terms of what folks are using. But it's really hard. There was some recent literature out there that says even among folks that use cannabis frequently, they don't have a good grasp of the product that they're using and how much they're using. So really just trying to improve efforts to I think delineate between THC use and CBD use and the hybrid between the two.
Modality matters, right? I've heard even physicians make conclusions without data that, okay, you have cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, which is usually associated with smoked products, although there are case reports with edibles. And they'll tell, okay, you know, stop smoking marijuana, but use the edibles. It's like, but that's higher potency. That doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand the logic there. Or I don't know if you saw that the American Heart Association just published, you know, major report showing, 300% increased risk of heart attack, stroke, coronary artery disease from marijuana. But I could see some people thinking, well, that's probably just smoked. Maybe it's okay to eat. But we don't know that.
Well, especially with the most concerning problem, or the most, I think, if I'm looking at, you know, the next 5 years in terms of what I am most concerned about in the cannabis landscape, it's these high concentrated products. And we're seeing these in edible products. Like it seems like there's no ceiling in terms of, I mean, they try to implement legislation in order to put caps on them, but there are still ways around them. I think cannabis hyperemesis, high concentrated products and these high concentrated edible products is where I'm most concerned about.
Yeah. And there have been deaths associated with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome as well. And it's, that's a daily diagnosis. That's something that we see every single shift. So for the data, like one of my goals that I failed on while I was at ONDCP is to create a dashboard for cannabis, right? I mean, like we have for opiates, we have a great opioid dashboard. So we could see the data. We know we're succeeding, failing, changing. And I thought that if we had the same data, kind of like what you're talking about, that's published on a regular basis, you could do it, you know, nationally, and then states can have it, like we have opioid dashboards. Are we looking at that? Are you, as a unit, looking at doing some type of dashboard like we have for opioids?
Yeah, so the best data that are being collected is at the state level. And some of these states are mandated to collect the data, you know, when their non-medical adult use laws were passed or the medical adult use laws were passed, for example. But the problem lies in what are they asking and how are they asking it, and you know, how are they capturing these data? So not all states are aligned in terms of what in terms of their cannabis questions and the ways that they're tracking it. So I think in an ideal world, all the states would be linked up and they'd be asking the same questions and tracking the same types of data so that we would have a good national picture of cannabis use across the United States. A few years back, we had a meeting with all the states that were all the non-medical and adult use states to get a better sense of where are the gaps in surveillance, what do we need to do in order to start to unify ways that we're collecting data. And I think it's a put, and the states want us to all want to be asking and capturing the same data, but there's just so many hoops that need to be jumped through. We currently do not have a dashboard for cannabis surveillance. I think it's something that it's in the pipeline but it's not in the short term pipeline. We're working with a couple of different research groups to try to piece together different data from states and to get a good picture in terms of a dashboard, but there's still a long ways to go. But that would be, I think in the interim, we're forced to just rely on individual states tracking.
Yeah, I think, you know, what the CDC does so well is setting a gold standard, right? When the opioid prescription epidemic hit, you know, we were making our own guidelines. Like I wrote a guideline for San Diego, and that was like 3 years before the CDC did their chronic pain guideline. But once the CDC had their guideline, that became the gold standard. Everybody follows that. And I'm wondering if learning from that experience, you can maybe not to the extent, because I know it took years of work to create, you know, that guideline for chronic opioids, but you can create, not difficultly, just a gold standard for a dashboard, you know, and knowing that a lot of this data is missing, like, you know, types of drugs, quantity of drug, that kind of things. But if you had your gold standard, like the gold standard for, you know, cannabis data collection is this, and if it with the CDC's unit, then everybody would reference that. It's like, you know, well, we should be following the CDC guidelines. We're not doing it for, are we collecting like they say to on their website? You know, what are we? So I think that would go a long way.
I love it. And we're in the process. So we had a 5-year strategic plan, and
yeah,
we're coming up to those 5 years, and we're in the process of starting to revise the five for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
So this is something that we've actively been talking about. So we're on the same page here.
I think that's awesome. And then it's like, well, you know, we just go to the web. That's what people do. Go to your website. And your website says this is a gold standard. You know, then that's what we do. So I love the fact that the cannabis strategy units under injury prevention makes sense. And the fact that you started your career working on car crashes, that's completely preventable. You know, I think like every fentanyl overdose is preventable. And that correlation in prevention and how it applies, you know, from car crashes to opioids and now to cannabis, how is that? How do you see that shaping what you're doing?
Yeah, I think it's the mindset that that all of this is preventable. All of the health effects are preventable. My background is in health behavior and health education, and behavior change is one of the hardest things that we can do. And I think it by starting to apply some of the well-known health behavior theories to the work that we're doing here in the cannabis strategy unit, and specifically focusing on some of these populations. So, you know, one of the populations that the cannabis strategy unit targets is young children, adolescents, and young adults. So this is where we know this is where the science is strongest in terms of the negative health effects of cannabis use. So we are we're looking to implement evidence-based. We're compiling evidence-based youth substance use prevention interventions and packaging them to in a resource for action that is specifically targeted at local coalitions, state coalitions, and it's all around the mind. And all of these interventions have to do with health behavior education, theory-based health behavior education. So,
and that's at a young age, or what age does that start with?
We're focusing on those who are high schoolers and younger.
That's awesome. I think that's where you need to go. I went to my daughter's preschool for her 2-year-old birthday, and I saw on the wall like a little, you know, like a motto, like, if you're stressed, this is things that you could do. You can take a breath. You could walk around. You could do a puzzle. You know, like, and I'm thinking they're teaching this to 2-year-olds, which is awesome. We need to continue this, like all the grades. Like, there, life gets hard even when you're 2 years old, and there are things you could do and not go to drugs.
Yeah, absolutely.
And are you involved with the educational, the evidence-based educational programs, like life skills? Is that kind of what you mean, that some states and school districts have adopted?
We're not directly involved in that work, but as part of this resource for action that I'm compiling and I'm leading efforts on, we're recommending different strategies, evidence-based strategies. So we're not necessarily naming specific interventions, but we're naming types of strategies that we know are effective. So so life skills training, for example, could be one. School-based interventions. Different interventions that are focused on the family and then policies.
Wow, that's great. And I love that, because in again, preparing for this, I like looked at the history. I was reading up on the history of the CDC, and it all started with the problem with malaria, right? And it wasn't like, okay, let's find some cool drugs to treat malaria. It's like, no, we want to drain the swamps and get rid of mosquitoes and go upstream. And that's exactly what you just said, is exactly what we're doing with drugs. We're going upstream, and like, we can treat substance use disorder. That's important. But if we don't want a next generation to continue needing these services, we need to go upstream. And that's exactly, I love what you're saying. I'm so excited for you. And that goes to my next thing, that I want to run a theory by you and see if you agree. Because I keep, you know, we all can't help but looking at the numbers of overdoses keep going up and up each year. And yet we look at the U.S. budget to treat or to deal, to manage, not just to treat, to manage this problem, this epidemic. And it goes up and up each year, more in billions of dollars. We're not making headway. And so why are we not making headway? And if you look at each individual program that the federal government does, it all sounds good. You know, like, you know, we want more Suboxone, great. We want more Naloxone, great. Harm reduction, great. I think the reason we're not making headway is because our investment of dollars is not placed appropriately. Like, you just said that you don't have a budget. Well, hello, you need a big budget. you know, I think when they started with malaria, when the CDC first started, they had 400 people dealing with that one problem. My theory is that we need to push that budget and reallocate it. The proportionality of it is not placed right. And that's why we're not seeing success.
Yeah. So one of the things that we're doing in the cannabis space in order to, use the resources that we have available to us is we're starting to work more closely with other federal agencies. And so there are other federal agencies that actually do have a cannabis budget. So we're working to make sure that, the limited funds that we have at CDC for cannabis work, or that we're using at CDC for cannabis work, are not duplicative or repetitive, or I guess duplicative of other activities that are going on across the federal government. We are talking with other federal agencies to, we'll share what we identify as the gaps in the cannabis space. We're seeing what they identify as the gaps in the cannabis space, and then we're talking with other federal agencies to what they have as gaps. And we're sort of starting to lean on each other and operate not in silos, but so that when we do have resources, we're making sure that we're using them so that it helps out agency A and B. And then when agency B has resources, they're talking to us to see where our gaps are. So it's very early, and we are starting to make headway in that space.
That's so smart. That's very smart, because you could work with NHTSA, like, and they're looking at the traffic fatalities and associations of cannabis, and they can work with you. Or mental health is a huge, I know people, there's lots of budget for mental health, and yet we're not looking at the mental health that starts with cannabis. And, I worked last night. I treated a lot of overdose patients, and I even admitted one. And I always ask people's journey to drugs, and they'll say, oh yeah, I started methamphetamines when I was 15. And I'll say, well, no, what's the first time? And they don't even think of marijuana as a drug. And I say, well, what about, when did you first start marijuana? Like, oh, I did that since I was 12. They don't even consider it. And invariably, I'd say 90%, we don't have this data, but if you would partner with the opioid people who are looking at the journey of people into drugs, they say, based on old data, that it used to be prescription opioids. I don't think that that's true anymore. I think it's marijuana, if you go back to what leads people to fentanyl. And before marijuana, it's those life skills that you were talking about.
That's awesome. We're also seeing that, getting back to one of your questions about some of the data sources that we're using, we're starting to look at national violence death reporting, NVDRS, National Violent Death Reporting System. So these capture all the violent deaths, including suicides. And we're looking at suicides among youth, and we're looking at toxicology, and we're seeing strong connections between cannabis use among those who have died by suicide.
It's huge. That's awesome that you can get that data. I was able to look at it for Colorado, and then based on Colorado's data, I asked for it for San Diego, and almost double, not quite double, but the number of deaths under the age of 25. And again, I'm not the epidemiologist, but I should have asked you first, but I just asked the medical examiner, give me suicides under the age of 25 and the drugs associated. And the number one was marijuana, almost double from alcohol.
Yeah. And correlation is not causation, but there's certainly prevention that can be done in order to that targets cannabis use, specifically among youth, that will have positive repercussions throughout the life course.
Right. And that's good. That's true. But you can see that association. And when it's so dramatic, it makes you, need to dig further.
Yeah.
Right. So when I was at ONDCP, marijuana was the M word, very hot topic, even today. I'm wondering, as an agency, what kind of feedback are you getting from other agencies within the CDC and without the federal government? Are you getting support, or is it like, that other unit?
Yeah, no, I think we're getting support. We, for the past 2 years, we were holding a meeting in DC where we brought together all the federal agencies that were working in the cannabis space, and you know, we would have to turn people away because there was so much interest. Yeah. And, you know, there are certainly some agencies that are more reluctant and to participate, but that's fine. I mean, each agency has their own culture, but I think overwhelmingly their support and recognition that cannabis is around, it's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Cannabis legalization is increasing, and we don't know what the future in terms of legalization looks like. But I think we all are sort of have to be ready for policy to change, and we don't want to be caught off guard. So, as you were asking, there's a lot of interest across different agencies and a lot of recognition that we need to be doing more in this space.
Yeah. It's kind of like the moonshine days of alcohol, right? It may be legalized, but it's just not regulated. And then states that legalize have this false impression that it's regulated and safe, which is misleading to the public.
Yeah. And talking about regulation, I mean, this is something that I'm thinking about those states that do not have non-medical adult use laws. Like I'll talk about Georgia, for example. You know, I lived there for 5-6 years, and before I moved, you could walk in, and I know that it's like this across most of the United States, you could walk into the gas station or the health food store and, you know, buy Delta 8 products. And there's a little stamp on the back that says that this has been tested, but who knows what has actually been tested and who knows what's actually in there. So when I was talking earlier about the potential for an e-valley, a new e-valley, like this is what I was referring to. Like there's no regulation and there's no testing, formalized testing in terms of what can be going into these products when you're not in an adult use state. So it's scary. It's scary.
And even not even talking about that, if you are an adult use state, the fraud that goes into the testing, that's another issue. So you have that, you got good support. I imagine everybody, I think that I always think I'm always a few years ahead of my time, but I think you'll be the most popular unit, with time. It's kind of like the tobacco unit in when it first started, it was like nobody paid attention to them. And then they became, you know, real key and made a huge difference. What about the other sides of the coin? Marijuana, again, is still a hot topic. It creates so much emotion on both ends. People who absolutely love their pot and the industry, and there's billions of dollars that marijuana industry wants to get, you know, ahead of the alcohol industry. So are you getting pushback on that end for any of the work that you're doing?
I feel like we've been pretty lucky, or at least we've done a good job in order to try to respond to that. I mean, we, you know, CDC, we do not say that we endorse cannabis use. We also we also recognize that for some situations there's therapeutic benefits. We also, whenever we talk about therapeutic benefit, we say that there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. So we do not, you know, you can review our website in that space.
Okay. I think I like what you said in the website, because you refer to the FDA, right? You're not saying be your own doctor, try some of this stuff. There's some therapeutic benefits. There's you very rightly say, you know, that if you therapeutic benefits need to go through the FDA process.
Yeah. And, but even in the therapeutic space, I was talking to one of the other federal agencies recently, and they were saying that they were doing some focus groups, and they learned that the population that was most likely to recommend cannabis use was the older adults. So they're older adults are, you know, we know that cannabis use among this population is increasing. They say that there's CBD is the cure all for anything, right? And we also know that CBD has drug to drug interactions. So even though they might be thinking that it cures arthritis or sleep or whatever, you have to, which the science is not strong on any of those, you have to be very, very careful about drug to drug interaction. So you're using this product that you think is safe, but you know, there's not good labeling and packaging on these products that really talk about drug to drug interactions. So there's I just caution that anytime that folks think that there might be therapeutic use, you have to dive a little bit more deeper into the literature to look at unintentional consequences.
I had a colleague email me yesterday with a study saying, "Hey, Ronit, what do you think about all these?" It wasn't cannabis. It was the psychedelics that are used, you know, to help with treatment. You know, should we be recommending that? I just replied, it's like, you know what? There's a lot of potential and a lot of different things, but, you know, we have to trust the FDA process. You can't have, because otherwise you end up what we kind of have now, which people just don't trust anything medical. They play their own doctor and they're buying stuff. They don't even know what they're using and creating a health disaster. On the other side of the coin, you haven't been, so I'm glad you haven't had any pushback because you're just sticking to the science of things. What about the parents? And the parents have always been, who have been affected by drugs in whatever way, have always been my moral compass. That's how I came to working in the issue of drugs is children who've been harmed by opioid prescriptions, where like I, as a doctor, was responsible. And that made me learn more and advocate and try to create processes to prevent that. And so now I'm seeing those same type of parents whose children have been either died or not functioning because of cannabis. And they're begging for more prevention, consumer protection. They'd be very excited to hear about the CDC strategy. But I'm wondering, how do you balance that with their plea to do more?
Yeah. So Drug-Free Communities, it's a grant program that actually is housed in the Division of Overdose Prevention. The Drug-Free Communities program, they fund 500 to 700 coalitions across the United States every year. And I think I'm going to get these numbers wrong, but I think they're 3 to 5 year grants. And they're small grants, but they're grants. And the intention of the funding is to focus on youth substance use prevention. So these small coalitions, they get a handful of money, and they are able to dedicate those funds for, you know, what substances are being used in their community. And I think this is where we're seeing the most interaction with parents. I talked briefly earlier about the Resource for Action, and this is a document that I'm designing specifically with those coalitions in mind. So if the coalition recognizes that they have a marijuana problem, and so they're able to open up the Resource for Action, be like, well, what are the different strategies that are evidence based that can be implemented in this community to start to, and these interventions can be tailored to that specific community. We hear from the Drug Free Communities program that marijuana and cannabis is one of the substances that there's the most concern about in these coalitions across the United States, because this is what youth are using most frequently. So I think the parents are huge advocates in order for Drug-Free Communities to do more work in that space. And it's so great that we have such a strong partnership with Drug-Free Communities.
That is awesome. That is awesome to drive that data with that information. So let's talk about trends. You're a trend expert. You've done several publications on different on such trends. So what are you seeing? And I know that you have the publication of trends and characteristics of cannabis associated with ED visits and also annual surveillance.
Yeah, so we recently published a report, I think it was about past summer, it was an MMWR report, and we were looking at cannabis-related emergency department visits from the year prior to COVID up until, I think it was the end of 2022. And we saw that during the pandemic, and this was among youth, and during the pandemic, emergency department visits for cannabis-related visits increased quite dramatically in, across all populations. Luckily, the emergency department visits started to decrease back to baseline for the older population, but those rates remain sustained higher for the youngest populations. So among those who are 10 or younger and those who were, I think, 11 to 15. And, you know, I think there's a host of potential reasons for that. Among the youngest population, so those who are 10 and younger, we're seeing that these youth are not consuming cannabis because they want to consume cannabis. Most likely, these youth are getting into their parents' edible products, and as legalization continues to increase and access to cannabis products continues to increase, this is a problem that is not going away. So those who are, if you have cannabis products in your home, whether it be legal or illegal products, they need to be treated just like how you would treat
a gun.
Yeah, a gun or prescription drugs that are deadly. If they are in the wrong hands, they need to be in a locked box out of sight from youth. Because I mean, there are cases when youth get into these products that, you know, they could end up in the pediatric ICU or worse.
Right. And we've seen that regularly. And then we're seeing it now in schools where people bring these gummies and candies to school. And, you know, and then there's a cluster of people, of kids from school that end up in the emergency room.
Yeah. So then we also saw that among the 11 to 15 year olds, their cannabis involved ED visits were remained elevated following the pandemic, if you will. And you know, the data that we had access to, we were really just looking at emergency department visits. We weren't able to have follow-up interviews or anything of the sort. We were seeing that there was a switch in terms of patient sex. So the data that we were looking at prior to the pandemic, males in this population had a higher rates of cannabis involved visits. But during the pandemic, it switched to females among this population. So I think that sort of speaks to how, you know, the stress related to the pandemic may have interacted differently among females and among males in this population, or different stresses, you know, females may in this
age. I also can't help but think that, you know, at least in California, cannabis was considered an essential service. Like, you couldn't go to the gym and you couldn't go to church, but the cannabis shops were like, you know, had a line, you know, to get in.
Yeah. And luckily we've seen, so there were a lot of policies that were implemented in the emergency that luckily have been reversed. So, but there's also a lot of the policies that have remained the same, such as curbside pickup, deliveries, delivery services. You know, these sorts of policies that's really started during the pandemic, they're potentially harmful because it exposes youth to. It provides more access to youth in terms of, you know, seeing their parents that they model or other folks that they model, you know, not necessarily using substances, but accessing the substances.
Oh, yeah, because you're a kid. You could just, you know, get it delivered to whatever your house or gas station and pick it up. Nobody's watching.
And it normalizes the behavior, too.
Right. You know? I wish I could get my own prescriptions from the pharmacy delivered so easily. So any other trends? I know that another publication that you did about was these Delta products or these semi-synthetics.
Yeah, so this is a space that we've been having increased talks with FDA about. It's you know, you have these novel hemp derived products. So you have your Delta 8, Delta 10s, the list goes on. We're trying to keep a pulse of these products because it seems like every few months there's a new product that is becoming popularized, and oftentimes they're able to be sold in a lot of states because of the way that the farm bill was written, and these companies are trying to they're constantly modifying the different chemistry of the cannabinoids in order to have them be legal and able to sell in these different marketplaces. And we don't have a good nobody knows the true effects of these products, both short-term and long-term. We're working with FDA using their adverse reporting systems and surveillance. We're just trying to keep a pulse on them and respond to them when we can. For example, for about a year and a half ago, we put out a health alert notice when Delta 8 was just hitting the marketplace to say that, well, we're seeing a lot of poisonings with this product across the United States. So it was able to alert medical providers across the country to be on the lookout for these sorts of products. And, there are different ways that once we learn about them, that we can communicate it with the public. But it's just these products are constantly changing, and unfortunately,
it's interesting when you said that, like, this has been tested on what? I don't think they've been tested, not even on rats or mice. Right. They're being tested on your children.
Yeah, so it's we're trying to keep a pulse on them, and unfortunately, we don't know about them typically until they start showing up in the emergency departments.
And even then, we don't know because. I can't test for my drug screens don't test for Delta 8 or Delta 10 or the new one I heard of THCO acetate and THCP. These I have to learn about that from law enforcement.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting.
Yeah. So this is another example of it's hard to have surveillance of these products when folks are not necessarily sure what they're using, or medical providers don't necessarily know what their patients are using. So surveillance of these hemp-derived novel cannabinoids, it's quite difficult. So we are turning to some social media sources. So we recently did an analysis using Reddit data to look at sort of reasons for why people were using Delta 8. We're trying to be creative and innovative with some of these different ways that we're collecting surveillance.
Wow, that's very interesting. Do you partner, is your interest just in clinical, like what Reddit is saying about drug use, or are you also interested in like what law enforcement seizures are, is like what are these chemicals, or are you more interested in the clinical part?
Well, I think this gets back to what does CDC do versus other federal agencies. I think the FDA is more concerned with what is the chemical makeup, for example, of these products.
Yeah.
We're at CDC, we're more interested in who is using it, what are they using, why are they using it. And then how can we use those data to design safer environments and effective interventions?
I love it. That's been the formula of success for so many years for the CDC. I'd love to see that. And success in big ways. I see that with tobacco. I see that with car crashes. We've made real good headways in those things. I have no doubt that we could do that with drugs. I think just the effort needs to be focused, and exactly what you're doing. So how is CDC strategy unit? How are you coming up? You're writing the next 5 years. How do you continue to engage in this space moving forward?
How do we continue to engage in the space using forward? I think we continue to build our surveillance capacity. We continue to improve surveillance, improve the way that we're collecting data, make sure we're continuing to collect high quality data. We also know that given how small we are as a unit, we can't do this alone. We're building partnerships with states, because the experts in cannabis, they're all at the state level. Like these epidemiologists at the state level, and in the healthcare systems at the state level, like they know what is going on in their states. So we're constantly trying to increase those relationships. Again, I talked about having stronger partnerships with other federal agencies such as FDA, NIH, SAMHSA, and really just trying to put out strong science, partnering with both academics and nonprofits, just trying to get our team together so that we can be as strong as possible and we can react to what are the biggest concerns in the cannabis space that we're seeing at the local level. And then also partnering with drug-free communities and pushing out resources that can be that are not only informative, but are actionable at the local level.
That's awesome. Dr. Doug Raylor, thank you so much. Thank you for the work that you do, the science that you bring, the upstream prevention. Again, new unit, small but mighty, with a lot of potential, a huge amount of importance, really proud. The CDC for having this focus and the work that you're doing. In any way that we can help you, we will do. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.